I'd like to welcome you all here today. We have a couple sessions here on collaboration at this end of the hall. And we've got some interesting, I think, some speakers here that I'll share with you some of the pros and cons of collaboration. And what's interesting about collaboration is that usually it generates a fantastic final product. But usually in the course of getting that final product done, or the actual project, or the whatever it is that you're working on, there's usually a little bit of trouble trying to work out the details. And sometimes when you have multiple organizations from different sorts of genres, you'll have some problems trying to get everything situated and working smoothly initially. And then later on, it starts getting rolling fairly rapidly, and then in the end, usually everyone's fairly happy with the final product, or at least most people ended up in a positive note in a final report. Some of the speakers that we have today, they've dealt with projects for a number of years on a variety of levels. Some of the things that we've done, for example, at Missouri State University, is we've worked with various community groups that are outside of the university, outside of an academic environment. We've dealt with the African American community to build up the African American archives. We've dealt with the gay and lesbian community to build up their collections in the Ozarks region. And that's in an area that isn't traditionally thought of as having African Americans and gays and lesbians. It's usually considered a very white bastion of culture in the Ozarks. So we try to reach out to different groups, and we work collaboratively with them in order to document those subgroups that we have in the Ozarks. So I'll go ahead and just kind of briefly introduce everybody. I've lost the introduction somewhere between here and the Lincoln Memorial. And so I'm going to kind of just mention their first names and last names, and then where they work. And then we'll start off with Ms. Michaelis, who will talk to us from the Kansas State Historical Society. I'm Dave Richards, and I work with Missouri State University. I'm the head of Special Collections and Archives there. Directly to my left is Laura Helton from the University of Southern Mississippi. Right now she's with the Mississippi Digital Project in Jackson, Mississippi. And then to her left is Pat Michaelis. I pronounced that correctly?
Yes.
And she's the director of Library and Archives Division at the Kansas State Historical Society in Topeka, Kansas. And then we have Jelaine Chubb at my far left down there. And at the time we did this, she was with the Missouri State Archives when this proposal was put forward, and now she's in Ohio. She's the State Archivist of Ohio. So we're really pleased to have all three speakers here. Pat, would you like to start us off here?
Thank you, Dave. If I start winding down and you can't hear me, just wave your hand. People tell me I have a tendency to start loud and kind of taper off. So I'm going to be talking about two different collaboration projects that we've been involved in the last few years. One will be about a digitization project with a special collections unit at a neighboring university, the Kansas Collection at KU, which resulted in a project called Territorial Kansas Online, and there are some cards about the project at the back of the room. The other is about a virtual repository project that we've undertaken with our state library in Kansas. The digitization project was an intentional partnership. We put together a joint application to submit to IMLS that was funded. And the other project, the virtual repository project, just happened, or as one of my colleagues earlier this week said, evolved, and some of us in Kansas do talk about evolution, because the state legislature changed a law that allowed agencies to submit reports that were required to be submitted to the legislature. They allowed them to do that electronically. Both the State Library and the Historical Society were charged by law with collecting state publications, and so we felt we needed to come. We testified about our concern that those electronic publications wouldn't make their way to our collections. We didn't oppose the law per se. The committee said, okay, go find a solution. Of course, offered no money and no other kinds of things. And so we just went ahead and decided to, we set up a committee and worked through things. Both of these projects really involved first in their specific area for all of the institutions involved. So it was really the first major digitization project that either the Historical Society or the Kansas collection had undertaken. And it was also the first kind of virtual repository project that we undertook. The digitization project was focusing on the upcoming sesquicentennial of the creation of Kansas Territory and the subsequent labeling of that conflict that became Bleeding Kansas. Both institutions had the best collections. Our institution and the Kansas collection had the best collections from that time period. Our audience was middle and high school students and teachers. Ultimately, we put up over 2,000 items consisting of 10,000 pages. As I indicated, it was the first effort for us in digitization. We underestimated the time. We ended up with two extensions. So what was initially planned as a two-year project became a four-year project with about 9 months of planning on the front end. So it was almost a five-year project. And so some of the things I'll talk about later, relate to that. On the second project, the electronic state reports to the legislature, we didn't really know what we wanted the solution to be. We gathered together a committee to discuss the options that included our DISC, or Division of Information Services and Communications, in state government, some representatives from the legislature, the state library, and the Historical Society. Kansas had been developing guidelines and exploring other issues related to electronic records preservation, or the Historical Society had been developing guidelines and exploring other issues related to electronic records preservation since the late 1990s. The committee was chaired by the state CIO. Ultimately, we decided on an online solution and that it would be a joint venture between the state library and the Historical Society, and that we would try a prototype of the project in DSpace, which has since become KSpace. It was just being released as an open source application. Further development, we developed a grant application to an in-state funding agency to purchase hardware. And in 2005, we launched the prototype that collected all of the electronic reports that were submitted to the Kansas legislature that year. We're now in the process of planning for how to sustain this endeavor, the KSpace, and possibly expand it, looking at making it a repository for content from state agency websites. So I think our first part here was just to describe the projects, right, and then we'll be going through.
Yeah, we'll be describing the projects initially, and then we'll open it up for question and answer, and just sort of a general, it'll be sort of an open forum.
As Dave said, until about 3 weeks ago, I was employed by the Missouri State Archives, and since that time, I'm now in Ohio. But they seem to want to keep me on the program, so here I am. I'm going to try to give you a little background on the St. Louis Circuit Court Historical Records Project. This is a records preservation and access initiative undertaken by the Missouri State Archives. The access also includes a virtual repository for selected materials online. First, it's without a doubt the single most ambitious endeavor ever undertaken by the State Archives. And second, it quickly evolved into a partnership between state, local governments, universities, and legal and business organizations whose common goal is to make the unique records held by the St. Louis Circuit Court available to the citizens of Missouri, the nation, and hey, if it goes global, that's great too. The project's intent is to stimulate research that will lead to a greater understanding of Missouri's and St. Louis's place in the American past. First, imagine knowing that there's a treasure chest in your own backyard and that it's filled with an incredible wealth. Now imagine that you aren't allowed to dig it up or even to peek at what's inside. For years, that was the case with the records held by the St. Louis Circuit Court. Staff at the Missouri State Archives had made numerous overtures to the clerk's office for decades, offering to process the records and create an index that could be used to great advantage by researchers. We were rebuffed for a very long time. Luckily, the clerk's position is an elected one, and shortly after a new clerk entered office in 1999, he responded to another inquiry. After assuring him that we had no interest in acquiring or taking his records, the clerk, Mariana Favaza, invited the State Archives Local Records Preservation Program to initiate a project to preserve and make accessible those historic records under his control. Dating from December 1804 and the establishment of the judicial system in the newly acquired Louisiana Territory, the St. Louis, Missouri Circuit Court retains millions of records that document the judicial, social, cultural, and economic history of the city, state, and nation. The case files from the territorial and early statehood period and beyond possess exceptional evidential, informational, and intrinsic value, documenting the legal basis of the early court system, profiling local individuals of national prominence, and illustrating broad themes of American intellectual and social history. Leading figures of the westward expansion are included in the collection, such as Lewis and Clark, Senator Thomas Hart Benton, and Moses and Stephen F. Austin. The original Dred Scott case filing is just one of over 300 freedom suits that date from as early as 1806. These records comprise the largest single collection of historically valuable records in Missouri never systematically reviewed by historians. To make the project or the processing the project manageable, the archives decided to restrict its work to those records created before 1875. That's the year in which a new state constitution made St. Louis an independent city, and which also roughly marks the end of the post-Civil War and Reconstruction era. Structuring the project in this manner meant tackling approximately 4 million pages of documents that were often in fragile condition or in disarray. The extraordinary value of the records and the scale of the project led to the formation of partnerships to push it forward. In the fall of 1999, the St. Louis Bar Association and Metropolitan St. Louis endorsed the project, and they continue to serve as a sponsor. UMB Bank came on and gave us a lead donation of $10,000 to help support conservation efforts. We now have partners in our preservation efforts and money too. In the summer of 2000, archivists transported historical case files from the St. Louis Circuit Court building to the court's record center. It was a new space that was provided by the court for the processing effort, and a space for document conservation treatment as well. That same fall, Washington University in St. Louis agreed to create student internships for the project and to place documents concerning important historical themes online. In January 2001, the freedom suits brought by Dred Scott and his wife Harriet in 1846 became the first cases to go online, attracting nearly 1 million information requests from visitors from around the world. And that was just in its first year. Later that year, in 2001, American Culture Studies program at Wash U expanded their initiative by digitizing additional case files and creating a web-based search tool. Other institutions soon joined the project as well, including the University of Missouri St. Louis, which began sending student interns in the summer of 2001, St. Louis University in the winter of 2002, Southern Illinois University over in Edwardsville in 2004, and in the summer of 2001, faculty from each of these institutions, along with staff in the Missouri State Archives, organized an academic advisory committee for the project to help select series for digitization and to discuss methods to stimulate research and teaching and using the records. Work on the St. Louis Circuit Court records expanded again on July 7, 2000, when President Bill Clinton officially designated the records that date from 1804 through 1830 as an American treasure and announced that the Missouri State Archives had received a grant from the Save America's Treasures grant program to provide conservation work on the collection and also to do preservation microfilming. And in the press release at that time, the White House characterized the records as a premier judicial collection documenting westward expansion during the territorial and early statehood period, 1790 through 1830, and illustrating broad themes of American intellectual and social history. In December of 2002, the Missouri Historical Society agreed to loan its collection of circuit court records, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on, which dated from 1804 to the State Archives for inclusion. As of today, over 9,300 images from over 300 freedom suits, 70 cases relating to the St. Louis fur trade, 32 cases involving Native Americans, and 98 cases relating to Lewis, Clark, and members of the Corps of Discovery, all previously unknown to history, are available online through the St. Louis Circuit Court Historical Records Project website. And most recently, the Missouri State Archives also received an NEH grant in the amount of $320,000 to hire four processing archivists to come in and work on a collection of 86 cubic feet of post-Civil War era records dating 1866 through 68, and that's just 2 years. There's tons of litigation right after the Civil War that involves slaves, property, jurisprudence, and those are going to be looked at over the next 2 years, and we hope to put those online as well. And there are additional collaboration efforts underway even as I speak.
Okay, well, like Jelaine, I have recently moved, so I just actually finished my 2-year stint as field archivist for the Mississippi Digital Library, which is a national leadership grant project that was funded by IMLS in 2003, and which is still in the works. So unlike these projects, which are sort of finished or have the first stage is finished, we're still working on our first stage. The Mississippi Digital Library represents the first effort to build a statewide digital library of archival resources in Mississippi, with an initial emphasis on primary sources and finding aids associated with the history of the civil rights era. The activities of the project thus far have included a collection survey, conversion of finding aids, of legacy finding aids to EAD, selection of items for digitization, resolution of intellectual property issues, scanning and metadata creation, and planning for global internet access through a consortium database and website. The Mississippi Digital Library is not the first collaborative venture ever to take place among archives in the state, but it is the most ambitious in size and in scope. It brings together six institutions, which are Delta State University, Jackson State University, the Mississippi Department of Archives and History, Tougaloo College, the University of Mississippi, and the University of Southern Mississippi. These six archives are incredibly diverse in their structure, size, and experience. Represented among these six are four public universities, one private college, and a state agency. They are scattered across the state from southern to northern Mississippi. The smallest college involved has less than 1,000 students, while the largest has more than 15,000. Two of the colleges and universities are historically black, while the other three were all white prior to desegregation. They represent all staffing levels, from a university with five full-time faculty-level archivists and special collections, to one university that has no full-time staff of any kind working in the archives at the moment. The facilities range from the brand new high-tech state archives building to a college library that often has no working air conditioner in the summer. At the time the grant was awarded, some of the institutions already had existing digital programs with electronic finding aids or digitized exhibits or collections, while another was just beginning to set up its OPAC, and another had no information about its archives available on the university website at all. So we had this very wide range of institutions to pull together. In light of this diversity, the establishment of the Mississippi Digital Library recognized two factors that all of the institutions did have in common. The first was that all of the institutions had valuable materials documenting the civil rights movement, and that all of the institutions could benefit from enhanced access and data sharing. Mississippi's archives hold letters, diaries, photographs, state and organizational records, and oral histories from civil rights workers as well as segregationist public officials. And these collections provide firsthand documentation of the history of race relations in Mississippi, which is a state history, but it's also a national history. And yet these collections are dispersed in archives separated by as much as 250 miles. And there was no existing means for informing researchers of related collections that were held by different repositories. So digital technology offered Mississippi an opportunity to bring these important resources together to support education and research. The second factor was the financial reality in Mississippi that threatened to preclude key repositories from developing digital programs on their own. Public universities in Mississippi face, not unlike other states, face recurring budgetary cuts in a state that is always already in the bottom five among the states in appropriations for education. And for private, historically black colleges in Mississippi, the struggle to survive financially has not lessened. In the past several years, two HBCUs in Mississippi lost accreditation and were forced to close their doors permanently. Thus, focusing on local projects with decentralized production would prevent participation by key repositories that individually lack the resources to sustain a digital effort. As a result, an objective of a collaborative program in Mississippi should be to help some repositories to maximize current investments, such as at the University of Southern Mississippi, which had already established a successful Civil Rights in Mississippi digital archive that was supported by IMLS, and in other cases, to empower other repositories to take advantage of digital technology where otherwise it would be beyond their already stretched resources. In this model, each repository contributes according to its means, most often with collections and expertise, and they receive training, while much of the infrastructure and technical work is centered in just a few locations where the state can leverage existing commitments. This model of collaboration allows smaller institutions to begin digitization in partnership with institutions that have the relevant experience and capacity to support it. And it also provides economic savings for all repositories with certain components like shared staff. We had a shared field archivist, which was my position, and also a shared metadata librarian, also centralized electronic storage and delivery, and shared descriptive standards. The project is still in the works, so it's hard to evaluate it at this point. But I can say that one of the, we're going to talk about this more later, but I'll go ahead and say that one of the greatest challenges has been, on the one hand, providing a high degree of centralization, and on the other, supporting varying levels of participation to allow for broad representation among the state's archives. And this balancing act has become more and more, or the need to strike this balance has become more and more evident as the grant has progressed. Providing for this flexibility has required a significant investment of time and travel to address the specific needs at each institution, to incorporate legacy finding aids from multiple generations and multiple institutions, to accommodate the use of different technologies and softwares on different at different facilities, and to work with new personnel that joined the project midstream as a result of natural staffing turnovers at each institution. I'm sure that we'll address many of those issues in the discussion to come. As the field archivist for the project, I was responsible for traveling around the state to work with each institution on a range of issues depending on the individual needs, from description and preservation to copyright and metadata. And in these travels, I learned quickly about the many questions and problems that are impossible to foresee when you write a grant proposal, and which are nearly impossible to resolve via email and phone. At the same time, because I was working at multiple institutions, I was also in a position to discover significant and really exciting connections between the materials that different institutions had, and that previously those connections had not been discovered. And had we not been working in a collaborative environment, we probably would never have discovered those connections. So although I can't speak for the 30 or so archivists that have been involved in this project, I'd say that we've had incredibly challenging moments as well as really rewarding ones. And also the project director for the Mississippi Digital Library, Diane Ross, happens to be here, so she may be able to help us answer some of the questions that come up.
Okay. Well, and that's a good segue for sort of our discussion here.
Here we have three examples of projects where there's really good reasons to collaborate. And we have good, you know, whether it's the materials are really valuable or there's economic factors involved for them to go ahead and collaborate. I guess I'd like to open it up to kind of find out what was probably the biggest hurdle or problem that you encountered in each of your collaborative projects. And I guess you could kind of talk about the solutions if you want to. Some of them are in the works right now. And obviously for a large collaborative project, if that's currently going on, if there's a major issue like with staffing or budget, you probably don't want to mention any names at this stage, otherwise you might shipwreck the whole project. But I thought, why don't we try at the far end there, Jelaine, why don't you share with us some of the problems that you came across? I mean, circuit courts and academic institutions, that's a lot of different, and several academic institutions.
Several academic institutions. And one of the issues is that everyone has their own list of wants and needs for the project, what they would like to get out of it. Coming together and deciding on an approach that's going to allow, if not all of their wants and needs and desires to be met, then a great deal of them, or the most important ones, coming up with an agreement, a collaborative agreement, the memorandum of agreement to begin with was quite difficult. It required probably a good 3 months of negotiation back and forth between the circuit court clerk's office, which is a political office, the Missouri State Archives, which is also within a political office, and Washington University in St. Louis, which is a private educational institution. Everyone had their desires for what they would like to get out of the project and what they thought they could put into the project. We had to make sure that while Washington University in St. Louis was offering to host the website, that we could work out the communication issues and the technological issues that were involved in this kind of project. We involved a lot of our staff in that, and it just took an enormous amount of time. So just jumping in, and that's what we did, was to just sort of jump in all of a sudden, say, oh, we're going to do a collaborative project. And the people at the top hadn't really talked about any of the nuts and bolts at all, so communication.
What, for those of us who aren't familiar with it, what is a memorandum of agreement, and why was that necessary? Why couldn't you just write something up in a grant proposal and go with that instead of having this formal document that you're talking about?
Well, once again, because everybody wants something out of the project, and they wanted to have it written down. What was WashU going to put in? They were going to put in an enormous amount of staff time and money to buy scanners, to scan the documents, to pay students and staff to do that scanning, and to help with the metadata and to work with our staff. They were also going to host the website. One of the big issues is, what are we going to call this project? And if it's on your site, what are we going to name it? That was specifically important to them. But basically, it just sort of irons out or decides who's going to give what to the project. What are the requirements? And then what are the desires out of it? And I've got this is a two-page memorandum of agreement, and as I said, it took 3 months to work it out.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, the session title is Beyond the MOU or Beyond the mm-hmm. Memorandum of Understanding, and my first response was going to be, what MOU? Because we didn't do one. And, you know, for the first project, the digitization project, you know, the grant proposal kind of sketched out the parameters of the MOU, but what could have become the basis of an MOU. But the other project really just did evolve as time went on, and we're to a point now where we're doing planning for long-term sustainability. And in our project with the State Library, it really has become a very uneven partnership, with the Kansas State Historical Society doing most of the work and one on government documents cataloger from the state library participating a lot. But other than that, having someone from their administrative staff attend planning meetings. So we've had our staff doing all the technical work. And so if we go forward looking for funding from state government because we want this virtual repository to be viewed as an enterprise-wide solution, we will have to do a very formal kind of agreement that outlines who's going to be responsible for what. And I think, you know, that may be one of, when I was thinking about these two projects, that may be one of the differences. If you're doing a short-term project with a goal, you maybe can get by with an MOU. But if you're going to do something, or in this case, the court things are taking lots of years to get done. But anything that's intended to be kind of a permanent product, probably at some point you do need to do an MOU so that it's clear what everybody's roles and responsibilities are. In terms of the problems we encountered, you know, I think the foreseen ones were in both projects we were undertaking new initiatives. So everybody involved in the project was having to learn as we went along. And that meant we sometimes, you know, we tried to learn from other institutions that had done these things. But in looking at the first project, the digitization one, technology on the web was changing drastically. When we submitted the grant proposal, we envisioned a website that was going to be static pages. And so we had funding in the grant to do, you know, somebody to do HTML and conversion of static pages along with for the description and all the other content besides the images. We weren't into the project very long before we decided that it really was going to be better to present that content dynamically. And so that required we needed different technology skills and different technology resources to do it that way. And so we ended up we did do a formal contract with them, with the academic computing at KU, who developed a database for us and hosts the website and continues to do that. So, you know, I think one of the things you have to be prepared for is a lot of flexibility, particularly if you're doing technology projects, because technology changes so quickly that you can't really be tied into doing that. And I must say that IMLS, from whom we received funding for the digitization project, was very easy to work with in terms of us saying, you know, the end product's still the same, we just want to get there by that route instead of this route. And then I think the things that were a little bit of a surprise to me, and they shouldn't have been, I guess, but you know, people think of government as being highly bureaucratic. Well, at least in Kansas, at the state government level, and inside the Kansas State Historical Society, we're fairly flat. So I could participate in discussions and be part of a project team, and if it was within my budget capabilities to say, okay, we can commit to do this or we can commit to do that, I could say that in a meeting and it was a done deal. The university had some varying levels of Deborah, who works for the Kansas collection, just looked at me in amazement. So. So at KU, within you have the bureaucracy within the KU library system, of which the Kansas collection is part of the Spencer Research Library, which is part of the university libraries, which is part of a division within KU, but not at all connected to academic computing. And so, you know, we ended up working with two different bureaucracies. Not that it was unworkable, it took a longer time to get any kind of decisions made. And so it sort of made me appreciate the flatness of what we have at our institution. And then the other, and Laura has already alluded to this, for any kind of long-term project, you have to anticipate staff changes. And so you need to think about what you're doing in the project, you know, not just tied to a particular person, but to the kinds of skills you need, so that person changes. And again, I think at the time we were starting this project, the Kansas collection was going through a lot of changes that the
the head of the Spencer Research Library is changing. Two of the key people on our project had their jobs changed in the course of our project or had additional duties added on. And it really is, and the same was happening in our institution with some additional duties, but you just, you know, I think you just have to know that you're probably not going to be dealing with the same people at the end of the project as when you start out. And at times you may have to scramble. If you have a person leave that has key skills that are important to your project, you may be scrambling for a while to get that position filled.
A year. A year. Something similar happened, yeah, with us.
Yeah, I think the challenges we've encountered have been both logistical and broader than that. I mean, logistically, and we've talked about this a little bit, time and bureaucracy, you know, we were a project funded for 2 years. It's been going on for what, 3? We're not done. So yeah, it's turning into a 4 to 5 year project. You know, all of you who work at universities or state agencies know what it's like to navigate those bureaucracies. In this project, we were doing that times 6. So something that you think might take 3 months at your own institution takes 9 months to do collaboratively. And that's been true for every single piece of the project. And that's something that I don't think we anticipated, because in Mississippi, we've never done a statewide collaborative project like this before. So time and bureaucracy logistically have been big challenges. And I think if I were going in the front end of a grant project in the future, I think I would know better to plan for that. And the other thing is that, you know, this was a new initiative on a couple levels. For some institutions, digitization of any form was a new initiative. And for other institutions, this collaboration was new. And that really involves each, like, two levels of having a vision. On the one hand, you have the vision for the collaborative, and on the other hand, each institution has to kind of know where it's going. And with digital programs, that was in flux for everyone. And so when the grant was written, some institutions, you know, had no digital program in the works. And by the time we were halfway through the grant, they had hired a digitization librarian, or they started to go in a particular direction. So it was very hard to harness where each institution was going with trying to all go in the same direction when that was all in flux. I mean, staff change has been a huge challenge for us. We realized at some point that there was not a single institution involved in the grant where either the archivist or the head of special collections had not changed. So the person who signed 5 out of 6 of the memoranda is somebody different now. So staff change at every institution, and the problem that has created is that the memoranda that were created at the time the grant was written for this project were very short. They looked like this. And that's great in the sense that it's very flexible. You know, it says things like, you know, that this institution agrees to provide existing archival finding aids for conversion to EAD, or select documents to be digitized at a central location. You know, so it's very flexible, which is great, except that the person who signed that and knew what it meant isn't there anymore. So the rest of us have to kind of figure it out and invent it. And in 2 cases, we rewrote the memoranda later, and they were several pages long to really spell it out, because we realized we just couldn't, we didn't know what we were all trying to be too flexible, and so no one quite knew what we were supposed to be doing.
In these cases of collaboration, was there ever a time that you thought you'd just give it up and maybe just go here by yourself? You know, Jelaine, was the Missouri State Archives prepared to just take over any of this and decide, well, it's not worth it?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. If we wanted to just process the records and make them available by microfilming them, we could have done that. If that was the intent of the project, if that's where the vision stopped. But we thought we have such a cache of important records here. And by microfilming them and putting out a finding aid, people are still, they're not going to find these records and be able to utilize these records for their research. And we thought, especially after we discovered the Lewis and Clark records, and then we started finding all of these freedom suits, and we were amazed by what we were seeing. We knew that it was bigger, that it could be bigger, that it could be better, but we also knew we didn't have the funding for it. Now, the local records preservation program was able to bring in a number of our field archivists from around the state to come in and start doing some intensive processing. We actually put them up in hotels in St. Louis, and we'd have a group of them come and stay for a week, and then they'd go home, and others would come in. So we were able to do that for a good long time because the local records program is fee-funded, and we had some additional monies we could use. But we knew that we couldn't go beyond that. Kenneth Wynn, the state archivist, and a Washington University graduate, thought about calling up a couple of friends and saying, hey, would St. Louis University like to partner? And maybe we can get some interns to help us with this. And then we got in touch with the Bar Association and thought, these are great St. Louis, you know, legal records. Maybe the Bar Association is interested in helping to fund some of our costs that are sure to be associated with this. After people started talking about the project and got excited with it, all of these other ideas came up of how can we expand it. When the thought of digitizing the records came on board, we knew that we ranked very, very, very low in terms of the Secretary of State's office, IT department's list of priorities. There's elections, there's business services, there's corporations. Way down at the very bottom would be anything that archives wanted to get up and on the website. That's changed a little bit now because they've seen numbers from our hits from this project and from some other things, but still low on the totem pole. It is something that garners a lot of votes for political offices. So it really was one of those things that if we're going to get this done, and if we're going to get it done soon, we've got a partner, and Washington University came on and offered us a lot. They offered us hosting the site, they offered staff, they came in, they set up computers and scanners and trained their student interns to come in and work, and then they paid the student interns to do this for us. So absolutely, it was essential.
And it sounds like in that case, and almost in Laura's too, Pat, maybe you can chime in on this, The very, very early seed of a collaborative project was the significance of the collection. In other words, you saw that collection and said, oh my gosh, this is good. I think a lot of people would jump on board with the circuit court records. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like with Laura, when it comes to civil rights, those records are so valuable in the state of Mississippi that that's another reason that we have to bring in multiple institutions, in which case, Tulane's, they were all located with the circuit court office, but in yours, you've got records all over the state, and you wanted to bring them together. So, and Pat, with your records, that was a pretty significant collection too to bring together?
Yes, it's a highly significant content, but the seed, the impetus for the digitization project was kind of the upcoming sesquicentennial and our institution wanting to do something to participate in that commemoration, but also, like in Laura's case, those records have national significance. And, if you're not familiar with the Bleeding Kansas era, that, it had a lot to do with the coming of the Civil War and the increasing tensions between the North and the South because of the rhetoric that was being spewed both in Kansas and nationally between slavery and anti-slavery forces. I think we needing to do something for that sesquicentennial, knowing that if we can get primary sources on the web, we can reach a much broader audience than ever can come to use our institution. And in terms of how we designed the website, we always kept in mind that our primary audience was middle and high school students and teachers. And so that really gave us kind of a focus. But I think on any of these kinds of major projects, you need to make sure that the project is important to your institution and it fits within their goals. I mean, our agency views students and teachers as one of our primary audiences, and so it fits into that. Doing something to commemorate the sesquicentennial. So, but if you're undertaking a project of this size, you really need to have the support within your institution way above where the project originally was.
At any time did the State Historical Society think problems with their partners were so extreme that they thought, well, it'd be better if we just did this by ourselves.
No. We get that way a little bit with the state library, but we end up doing all the work anyway. But I think in the long run, the fact that the project with KU really went very smoothly. I think the problems were more in terms of the KU staff being able to make the time to work on this project with all the other changes that were going on there. And it was a real plus when we decided to change our strategy of how we were going to present things on the web to be able to use KU's academic computing services.
You know, that is existing,
but
it's now part of the library.
Yeah.
I would like to think, I'm sorry to add to people, but it may have been, it's an excellent emphasis and rationale, because we were one of the first ARLs to engage in combining technology.
Feel free to jump in at any of this. We decided it would be an open session.
I'm sort of defending it, but also supporting the past observations.
But and on the other project, whatever the headaches are, I mean, there's no way I wanted to go down a road where the state library was coming up with one solution to preserve electronic publications, and the historical society was going another direction. Within our institutions, we don't have enough resources, and within the state, we don't have enough resources. And the fact that, you know, as we go to our funders, and probably specifically the legislature, saying, you know, this is something that's happening within state government. We're proposing an enterprise-wide solution. We're working on this together. You know, it's going to be much, I don't know if it'll be easy, but it'll be much more rational in terms of the argument we present to try and get funding for a sustained version of this than if we weren't doing it cooperatively. So.
Laura, what point yours is still underway, so you probably want to keep it a little bit low key. problems.
Well, a few people threatened to, you know, cross state lines and never come back. No. No, I mean, I think, you know, the it's been very challenging, but the goodwill is enormous. And that's really heartening, too. And I mean, in Mississippi, like I said, that these institutions are very diverse. Some of the institutions have collaborated with each other in the past, but it's not a state where collaboration has been the norm. And, you know, like I said before, half of these institutions are historically Black and half are historically white, and they have not always worked together well in the past, clearly. And so there have been a lot of challenges, but in terms of all the staff, everyone's really, really enthusiastic about it and eager to do it. So everyone's willing to, and people have been willing to put, go through a lot of bureaucratic challenges, you know, because they really want to do this, and because I think the benefit to many of the institutions is so great. You know, when we get really frustrated, something really exciting will happen that kind of gets us, energized again. And this material is very time sensitive because it is civil rights era material. A lot of the civil rights activists passed away in recent years. And so when something happens, like we track down one of these civil rights activists and they're in the nursing home, but they're excited to hear about the project and they give permission to digitize their papers. When something like that happens, I think everyone remembers why we're doing it, and that helps.
Yeah, I'd have a hard time imagining Ole Miss cooperating with Mississippi State. That doesn't sound like that. They're going along too well.
If I could just add to that for a second, Laura's looking at me and laughing when she says things because I was going to say. In terms of tangible
people, I mean, a lot of what we've been doing is relationship building, and that takes a long time, and you don't see the results of that. But you can't get anything done in a collaboration unless people trust each other. So, you know, in some cases, it's taken a couple of years for people to sort of think more about the collective value of the project and what's best for the materials and a little bit less about protecting their own turf. And that takes a while. You have to really trust the person you're sitting across the table from. And that's not easy. That's not easy in Mississippi, you know, but we're getting there.
And it's just now that I'm beginning to hear people say "we" in terms of this project, which is just a huge milestone to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good jumping off point for maybe our last and final kind of question for the panel here. You mentioned relationship building. You mentioned, Jelaine, earlier about how wonderful the final product's been in terms of number of hits mm-hmm. on your website. What would you say is the primary, or let's say the top three positive things that have come out of your collaborative project? Because we've kind of focused on the pitfalls and what some of the cautionary things are. What would you say is the most important benefit from having your collaborative project?
Number one is the delivery of the records online. We have received so many hits from all over the world. People accessing to begin with when the first collection or the first documents went online, those were the Dred Scott records. That made the national news. I mean, CNN picked it up, USA Today. We got tremendous response from that. And then that led to additional interest on the part of, again, Washington University and some of those other folks that ended up joining our collaboration. And then heightening the awareness even within the St. Louis Circuit Court's office and within the Secretary of State's office and other circuit court offices in Missouri that were about as old as St. Louis. They got interested and they said, hey, I've got records too. Want to come and work with us? And right now, currently, Missouri State Archives is working to preserve and microfilm and make accessible all the early territorial records from the five original districts in Missouri. If I try to name them, I'll get them wrong. But St. Genevieve, New Madrid, St. Charles, St. Louis, and Cape Girardeau. Okay. Cape Girardeau. Those districts, they're all interested, and we'd like to put those online in a collaborative website project as well. So that initial, our initial actions have created such response. And then I think the third thing would be working out a collaboration. We hadn't done that before. Working with a university, working with local government, working with some of these other institutions. I have to say that Missouri Historical Society was great about loaning us about 20 Hollinger boxes worth of circuit court records that had been given to them in the 1940s. These records had been kind of cherry-picked throughout this collection. I mean, we're talking about 4 million documents, over 11,000 case files from 1804 through 1830 that we know of, and at some point in time, somebody had gone in and cherry-picked, again, about 20 Hollinger boxes worth of materials. We approached their archivist and said, do you think you might want to loan those to us for reprocessing and inclusion in this project so that we could have, hopefully, as much as possible, an unbroken line of these documents? And they said, yeah. We think we can do that. And they were great. We picked up the records, reprocessed them, and in some cases we rebuilt a case file. We were rebuilding case files because someone had taken documents out of a specific case. So the St. Louis Circuit Court still had some of those records, and the Missouri Historical Society had some of those records. We brought them back together, and that was a unique situation. Those records have since been microfilmed or digitized as an entire series, and then they've recently been returned back to Missouri Historical Society, along with a full set of the microfilm as well. So I think they gained as well. You could access them, certainly at the Missouri Historical Society, they had access, but it was just, the name and plaintiff versus defendant in a year was given to the case file, so you didn't know what the subject matter was for those cases. And that was pretty much the situation in the St. Louis Circuit Court. As a matter of fact, these records were out in an area where people were walking through to go pay their child support payments. They were in till drawers. Somebody could have, just easily opened them up and taken them out. The Circuit Court had what they termed was an archivist. Actually, it was a woman who was in charge of data processing. and her name was Melvina Conley, and she was deeply interested in African American history, and she knew that those records were important, and she took it on as her personal mission to help researchers gain access to those records, and she would try to refile them and put them back and do what she could to preserve them. In some cases, there was some scotch tape that ended up on some records and some other things, but everything was very well intended, and she did a marvelous job of keeping those records intact. So yes, there was access to the records, but it was very limited. Not all of the indexes were available or legible at that time. We have since created a database entry for each case file that we had access to or that we could recover with its original case file date, year, plaintiff, full names of the plaintiffs, all the plaintiffs, all the defendants that were involved, what was the cause of action, when did it come before the court, when was it filed, when was it adjudicated, the judgment, attorneys involved, and of course, subject. What was the case about? Who were the prominent individuals involved in it? In a number of these cases, you'd have someone that you wouldn't recognize as a plaintiff and a defendant, but the witnesses or the attorneys involved were very important. And so it kind of it just added a lot more information out there in terms of access points. So I'd say that was a great benefit. A great deal. As a matter of fact, we received a grant from Save America's Treasures, the White House Millennium Council, $175,000 that would pay for microfilming and also pay for conservation treatment that we could outsource. Our in-kind match for that was at, the services of our three in-house conservators to work on that collection. And they did that for about a year with 100% of their time. Focused on that, and we would go through and select those records that had the most intrinsic value or were in the worst condition, and in addition to our archivists doing basic and minimal conservation treatment of cleaning years of soot and dirt and dust off these records, they either received in-house conservation treatment and sometimes backing or removing WPA conservation treatment efforts. A lot of things had been backed, and you really couldn't even try to microfilm them because you could barely see what there was. So a lot of remedial work went into that as well.
And where are these records now?
They are now housed. You asked about, what came out of this. I got to tell you, I should backtrack and say one of the greatest things that came out of this is the Missouri State Archives in June opened officially the St. Louis branch of the Missouri State Archives in the area that was given to us by the circuit clerk. And it is it's not fancy, but it's a research facility. The records are there. They're on the shelves. They're in Hollinger boxes. The records that we're processing are there as well. There is a little mini conservation lab, and there's room for additional work and scanning. But those records are now housed in St. Louis on the circuit court's property, but they're in our custody, if you will.
That's a good point.
Yeah. It's so recent, I'd almost forgotten.
It's hard to talk. We can't really talk about benefit to users yet, because we're not at that stage. But internally, one of the benefits has been just getting institutions statewide to be thinking long-term about statewide digital projects and about electronic records and what they can be doing together. And the three large institutions involved in this, University of Southern Mississippi, the University of Mississippi, and the Mississippi Department of Archives and History, all can really play a major role in the state in terms of being kind of regional centers of expertise for digitization and for preservation. And I think this project is sort of pushing those institutions in that direction. And the idea for this project is that it would start out with these six institutions with the civil rights focus, but that after the initial grant project was finished, it would expand for other institutions to get involved and for other subject themes. And people are already thinking about you know, a lot of people have said they want to join in the next phase, and people are thinking about, oh, well, can we tie things together with literature collections that are held by multiple institutions? Can we, some of the collecting and the collections that have been preserved after Katrina, could that be part of this? So there's a lot of people bouncing ideas around, which is really positive. So the second benefit has been, and I mentioned this before, discovering the connections between collections that were hidden not only to researchers, but hidden to the archivists as well. I mean, there's one case from 1970 of a shooting of two college students at Jackson State College in 1970 that we discovered that there are really significant portions of that collection held at three different institutions, and that none of those institutions had ever talked to each other about what they held and what those relationships were. So I think that's going to be a really big benefit, not just to researchers in the end, but to archivists as well, to just better understand what is in the state. And I think the last thing that's been a benefit that I can think of right now is just the value added for smaller institutions. This is a digitization grant, but as any of you who have worked on digitization projects know, there's most of what you do in a digital project is not digital. You know, it's planning and it's preservation and it's processing and it's sorting. And for smaller institutions that didn't have a lot of resources, they've gotten a lot of other services as part of this. I mean, there's one institution that has no archivists, no staff in their special collections. They lost the budget line, so there's nothing going on. And so, you know, as the field archivist, I was there 2 days a week and could help to process some of the collections because there was nothing to include in the digital library if all the material was unprocessed. So we were able to process several collections there and finish finding aids that, you know, had never gotten finished. And for another institution, they had a lot of conservation issues, you know, mold and flooding and really no physical or intellectual control over the materials, and, you know, having a permanent, sort of, not permanent, but a staff person devoted to helping them get their records digital ready was incredible. Just surveying the materials, knowing what they had, figuring out a way to keep track of it, and just getting basic processing done was something that there wasn't, you know, they hadn't really had access to, you know, that kind of capacity building. So for the smaller institutions, there's been a lot of value added that has nothing to do with digitization at all. Diane, would you add anything to that?
You hit the main ones. In fact, in your current project, you just don't want them to just go stagnant once it's over.
That's a good question, and I'm not sure there's been a very good solution for that. You know, definitely some of the staff involved in our project, you know, attended the HBCU Archives Institute, and also one of the key parts of the Mississippi Digital Library Grant is training. And so there's been a lot of training on different issues, and that helps sort of capacity building for the future so that institutions can carry on some of what's going on in the grant. But because of staff changes, I don't think that's enough. So that's definitely a big concern. It's hard to figure out how to do that in the context of a digitization grant, because some of these other things we're kind of able to sneak in there because they have to be done in order to digitize. But in terms of, you know, with some institutions, you know, we've worked directly with them in terms of trying to write grants for preservation and that kind of thing. But if they don't have a lot of administrative cooperation, then there's only so much that can be done. But that's definitely a big concern down the road.
One of the things I found interesting, what Jelaine was pointing out, was when that CNN report came out, it seemed like that big press coverage really got a lot of people excited at other institutions outside the state archives. Mm-hmm. And so then other circuit courts were looking at saying stuff like, oh, look, we have this and we have this too. We'd like to jump on board. Mm-hmm. I wonder too if on collaborative projects, when you do get a bit of good PR, everybody shares in that good PR. And that might be a way that other smaller institutions can go to their administrators and say, hey, look, this is what we can do with these collaborative projects, but also we have some good stuff that we can do independently and autonomously, you know, with some study funding or study staffing of some sort. Yeah?
This is why you should listen to me.
The whole mantra is flexibility. So it depended on the situation. In most cases, scanning was done on site where the materials were, because naturally people don't want to, you know, are nervous about sending their materials off site to be scanned.
By your people or by their people?
No, by their people. So part of what was written into the grant was, you know, the hiring of scanning assistants at participating institutions that would be trained by Diane, who was the project director. So the training and the kind of support would be centralized, but the individual staff people generally were at the site. In one case, the institution just didn't have the staff or capacity to support that. So those materials were transported to Hattiesburg, to USM, which was the hub institution, and there was a kind of centralized digital lab set up there. Those materials were scanned and taken back to their home institution. So the scanning was sometimes centralized and sometimes decentralized, depending on what people could handle. What was completely centralized was metadata creation. There was a metadata librarian in the centralized digital lab who would, the scanners would put in the most basic of metadata, you know, just technical and some really basic information about the materials, and then in the digital lab, the metadata librarian would flesh that out and clean it up. Because that was, I think, what everybody was most worried about, was how they were going to handle metadata. It's fairly easy to get a student to do the scanning and supervise them and make sure it's being done right, but metadata was making everybody freak out. So that was centralized. In terms of standards, we have both metadata best practices and EAD best practices, and those were drafted by centralized staff, but got input from people at each institution. So, like for our EAD standards, we were trying to figure out what, for the conversion of legacy finding aids, what's our baseline set of elements that every finding aid in this project needs to have. So, that basically we built on what USM had already done, because they had already done a digital project and they had a digitization manual and certain baseline standards that they had been following and that were written into the grant. And for almost every institution, we just carried those over, and the institutions, you know, agreed to adopt that. And so, you know, usually they would scan a kind of a test set of images and then send it to the digital lab to look at and make sure, okay, we're all on the same page, we're doing this, you know, we're doing this according to the same set of standards. And then, you know, the Mississippi Department of Archives and History already had their own scanning technical standards. So in that case, it's really going to be more sort of putting those two standards next to each other, seeing where the differences are and figuring out, you know, what's going to be the practice for this particular project. But in most cases, we just carried over what had already been developed by one institution. Does that answer your question?
I think so. It sounds like institutions that haven't done.
Well, they would have access to the scan to see the item and to use the item, and always with the ability to consult with the staff that, you know, was responsible for the collection if they needed to. But actually, it sounds like it wouldn't work, but you usually have the information that you need based on the object. And the metadata librarian sort of became she was kind of a subject expert, you know, through doing this, in terms of knowing a lot of the general historical context for civil rights in the state. Because this was all one subject area, it made this a little bit more possible. I mean, if we were taking collections from, you know, from Native American collections to, you know, industrial collections to something else, you know, that may be impossible for one person to do that. But because it was all one state and one, you know, 30-year time period, that person really became enough of an expert that she could usually do it. And USM also supported a bibliographic service, which was creating a civil rights and Mississippi thesaurus of subject headings, standardized subject headings that all the institutions used to assign to materials in order to keep the description standard, and also to fill in some holes in LC in terms of things that LC didn't have that we needed. Specific things were usually had to do very initially with kind of protecting turf in terms of it's hard to say. It really didn't have to do with the nuts and bolts. It's more just with even sort of getting on board with the project. And Diane, could you explain better?
That, I think more specifically, people were worried that once they're out.
Not really the issue, but then as a project becomes really successful, then who does want to toot the horn the loudest?
That was one of the things that came up. I actually think it's number 5 on our memorandum of agreement, because we were involved with 2 political offices and a university, and the university was going to host it. And we had to make sure that it didn't look like the university's product. The circuit court was very concerned about that. Our boss at the Secretary of State's office was very concerned about that. So we came up with something that looks sort of universal, but then we put each office's seal at the top. We put the right across the board, and then named it the Circuit St. Louis Circuit Court Historical Records Project, and that was extremely important. Our state archivist had a personal relationship. He had graduated from Washington University, and he was talking with some folks there one day about this project, and it was great that we got access to these historical records, and it just sort of evolved. I mean, they offered. They immediately made an offer and said, we'd like to partner with you. And thus, the partnership was born. I guess it's who you know.
Any other questions? Yes?
Well, just sort of a universal look to it, and then we've got everybody's, you know, particular seal or logo across the masthead.
Did you outsource the design, or was that a big headache, just how it's going to look in meetings?
We had, these were students at Wash U who worked on it. We kind of laid out what needed to, you know, there was lots of discussion about what it needed to look like, the colors involved, you know, how just even figuring out how are the documents going to look on the website? Were they going to be black and white? Were they going to be color? And if they were going to be in color, then making sure that the color around the masthead, you know, didn't detract from the document. Also making sure that the size was correct. Washington University, when they first said, oh, it's out there, go take a look on the test site, we came back and we said, whoa, these documents, it's nice to have this ability to see them really large, but they're way too big for most people to take a look at, because you had to scroll not only up and down, but side to side. And we said, no, that's too much fatigue. Let's take it down to, instead of like, I think it was 1,000, let's go down to like 750, make the image smaller on the screen, and then give people the ability to blow it up if they need to, you know, really see, is that word, is that an I or an E or an L or a T, or what is that letter? And also then, how are you going to be able to print? So there were lots and lots of issues like that that were important to us, but, you know, we worked it out.
Did you have to work fees into that? Was there any e-commerce, anything, or was that part of the agreement?
One of the first things is that we all agreed, the parties agree that the project is intended for non-commercial educational and research purposes, and that they're part of the public domain and not subject to copyright protections. That was key.
Well, that's a good first point there.
Yeah. Points 1 and 2. Yeah. I can't, because I'm no longer with Missouri, but you might be able to obtain a copy if you contact the state archivist.
Well, I'd like to thank all 3 panelists for keeping the discussion rolling, and also you for your questions. And I think that concludes our session. Thank you very much.